This is Wealth Wake Up with Dick Donahue and Camille Koppenberg. KGMI and the Cascade Radio Group receive financial compensation to present this program in its entirety.
The opinions voiced on Wealth Wake Up with Dick Donahue and Camille Koppenberg are for general information only and not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. To determine what is appropriate for you, consult a qualified professional. Investment advisory services offered through CWM LLC, a registered investment advisor. Carson Partners is a division of CWM LLC, a nationwide partnership of advisors. Guests on Wealth Wake Up with Dick Donahue and Camille Koppenberg are not affiliated with CWM LLC.
Welcome to Wealth Wake Up this Sunday morning. Dick Donahue with you here on KGMI. Jobs are booming. And when the scientists said 15 days to slow the spread, some of us actually believed that by Easter the shutdowns would end. That was last year. Now a full year and $5 trillion in government spending later, we may finally be getting our wish. On Good Friday, the Bureau of Labor Statistics released the March 2021 employment data, and payrolls increased a staggering 916,000 for the month, easily beating the consensus expected 660,000. Jobs increased most in leisure and hospitality, up 280,000, construction up 110,000, and education and health services up 101,000. Meanwhile, manufacturing jobs increased 53,000, while government jobs rose 136,000, almost all in education services. That is what we should have expected as unprecedented shutdowns ease. As we said weeks ago, the best stimulus is a COVID vaccine and herd immunity, which gives people confidence in return to a more normal life. We expect similar gains in jobs in the months ahead. In fact, we would not be surprised if some months of 2021 had job gains topping 1 million. We need it. In spite of the surge in jobs in March, total payrolls are still 8.4 million short of where they peaked pre-COVID, with the leisure and hospitality sector all by itself accounting for 3.1 million of that deficit. Most of those gaps should be closed by the end of this year. But completely closing those gaps won't mean the labor market is fully healed. Jobs would have been growing in the past year if COVID-19 had never happened, perhaps adding 2 million new jobs or more. Nevertheless, this is the world that we have created, and we have a hole to dig out of. And we're digging rapidly, indeed. The payroll data comes from a survey of businesses, while the household employment data is captured by talking directly to workers. As a result, includes small business startups that haven't yet made it into the business payroll survey. This alternative measure of employment increased 609,000 in March, and the unemployment rate dropped to 6%, even as the labor force, people who are either working or looking for work, grew 347,000, and the labor force participation rate ticked up to 61.5%. The March data also lifted by the fact that February was held back by harsh winter weather. We can see that this is in the length of the average work week, which fell in February, but rebounded strongly in March. Total hours worked, the average work week times total employment, rose 1.9% in March. That is a huge lift to overall economic output. If there was a negative part of the March jobs report, it was that average hourly earnings declined 0.1% for the month. However, we think the decline is a side effect of the otherwise very strong jobs report. COVID-19 and related shutdowns caused the most economic damage among service businesses that need many workers to interact directly with consumers, like at restaurants and bars. These workers are often younger and earn lower than average pay. So when these firms are rehiring workers, which is a good thing, that process can also temporarily drive down average earnings. In other words, we don't think the dip in average hourly earnings is worth worrying about. And when you combine the path of total hours worked and average hourly earnings, they show a robust private sector recovery. This measure of total private earnings hit a new all-time record high in March, up 0.7% versus the pre-COVID peak. When combined with trillions of dollars in stimulus spending that will roll out in the months ahead, we expect economic activity to boom. Jobs gains in the 7 million range, for all of 2021 and real GDP growth of 6% or more are highly likely if renewed shutdowns do not occur. Collectively, adding this increased savings rate to the gains in income, we expect households to have more money to spend than at any point that we can find in historical data. Growth and increased spending themselves don't cause inflation, and neither do budget deficits. Inflation is much more money chasing too few goods. So, if the government takes money from one person to redistribute it to another person, then there's no increase in overall demand. But if the government prints money to fund itself, and then the debt represents an increase in potential spending. And if government lifts tax rates, then output is hampered. That's our biggest worry for the next few years, watching demand soar due to 27% growth in the M2 money supply, while higher tax rates and more redistribution hold back output, leading to inflation. In the meantime, the economy is booming. Let's take a look at the global roundup this week. We saw that equities reached a new high as vaccination pace is quickening. Global equities traded close to or exceeded record highs, supported by signs of gathering economic momentum and on improving supplies of coronavirus vaccines. The yield on the benchmark U.S. 10-year Treasury note eased to 1.67% from 1.70% last Friday, while the price of a barrel of West Texas Intermediate crude oil slipped a dollar to $59.30. Volatility as measured by the CBOE Volatility Index, or VIX, fell to 16.5, the lowest level since February of 2020. And looking at some of the global macro news, U.S. services sector extends its recovery. The Institute of Supply Managers Service Sector Purchasing Managers Index surged to a record high of 63.7 in March, its 10th straight monthly increase as COVID-19 restrictions were eased in many parts of the country. The manufacturing sector reported a similar result last week as PMI jumped to 64.7. These figures comport with last Friday's robust 916,000 job increase in U.S. non-farm payrolls and suggests that the U.S. economy has a good deal of momentum heading into the summer months as the pace of the coronavirus vaccinations quickens to an average of 3 million doses per day. This week, U.S. President Joe Biden asked state governors to make all adults eligible to receive a vaccination starting April 19th instead of May 1st. As previously requested, Europe, which has experienced a slower vaccine rollout than the U.S. and the United Kingdom, has seen its vaccination pace increase in recent weeks as more suppliers have come online. And Biden is signaling flexibility on the U.S. corporate tax rate after receiving pushback from business executives and lawmakers in his own party on raising the U.S. corporate tax rate to 28% from 21%. It's 28 to 21. That's a 33% increase, in case you can't do the math. President Biden this week signaled that he is willing to be flexible on the top line figure. Many analysts expect the statutory rate to land somewhere around 25%. Biden is also said to be open to delaying tax hikes in order to garner support from Senate Republicans for his infrastructure proposal. GOP lawmakers have indicated that a $2.25 trillion plan spends too little on infrastructure, too much on longtime Democratic policy priorities. However, a favorable ruling from the Senate parliamentarian this week may make it easier for Democrats to pass more spending bills without any Republican buy-in. Dick Donahue with you with Wealth Wake Up here on KGMI. We'll be right back.
If tomorrow all the things were gone, I'd work for all my life, and I had to start again with just my children and my wife.
Welcome back to Wealth Wake Up. Dick Donahue with you this Sunday morning here in KGMI. Got questions for us? Give us a call. We're Asset Advisors. We are located out in Ferndale on the Pacific Highway next to Wilson's Furniture in the Pacific Commerce Center. Our address is 5060 Pacific Highway, Suite 101, Ferndale, 98248. Our phone number, 360-733-1200. Give us a call and check out our website at wealthwakeup.com. That's wealthwakeup.com. Okay, continuing on with this week's global summary, we're seeing that the International Monetary Fund upgrades global growth outlook. In advance of its annual meeting in Washington next week, the International Monetary Fund has upgraded its global economic growth outlook. The IMF sees 6% growth in 2021, up from its January forecast of 5.5%, which would be the fastest pace since 1980. The U.S. is expected to grow at 6.4%, up from 5.1% in January. Meanwhile, the Eurozone is expected to grow 4.4%, and that's up from 4.2%. Japan up 3.3%, which previously was 3.1%. China up 8.4%, up from 8.1%. And India is expected to have a 12.5% growth, up from 11.5%. And Italy issues a 50-year bond to lock in its low rates. This week, the government of Italy sold 5 billion euros worth of 50-year bonds to lock in favorable rates as it fund its COVID-19 recovery plans. Demand for the issue, which yielded 2.2%, was robust and nearly 13 times oversubscribed. Governments throughout the European Union have been heavy issuers of debt this year as fallout from the pandemic strained national budgets. In the first quarter, a record 333 billion euros in European government bonds have been issued. And a few quick hits here. The U.S. Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is considering a ban on most home foreclosures until 2022. And despite a slower-than-expected vaccine rollout, the European Union projects that it'll be close to reaching herd immunity from COVID-19 by the end of June. And United Kingdom Prime Minister Boris Johnson said this week that the United Kingdom will further ease COVID restrictions beginning the 12th of April, and that the country is on track for a full reopening by mid-June. France downgraded its 2021 GDP forecast to 5% from 6%. California plans to lift most coronavirus restrictions by the 15th of June if hospitalization rates remain stable and sufficient vaccine supplies are available. And the minutes of the March meeting of the Federal Open Market Committee, that's the Federal Reserve, highlighted an economic outlook that had brightened considerably since January, but remained far from the U.S. Federal Reserve's labor and inflation goals. Policymakers said the current inflation pressures are generally seen as transitory, and that they expect prices to edge downward in 2022. The committee felt that raising Treasury yields was not a concern unless the move became disorderly or persistent. The U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission warned companies about going public through mergers with special purpose acquisition companies, or SPACs, that they should provide clearer disclosures and address concerns about fees, conflicts, and sponsor compensation. And as earnings season gets ready to kick off this next week, FactSet Research reports that the consensus forecast is for a 23.8% year-over-year increase in the S&P 500 earnings for the earnings season that starts this next week. And got the monthly March producer price index report out this week. And the Federal Reserve wanted more inflation, and now we have more inflation. For the second time in 3 months, producer prices jumped by a massive 1% plus on a month-to-month basis, pushing the headline reading to 4.2% year-to-year, the highest in nearly a decade. The prices are accelerating, up at a 7.6% annualized rate in the past 6 months. Three things are going on. First, a base effect is making year-to-year comparisons higher because producer prices fell steeply last March during the onset of COVID-19. Expect more of that in the near future as prices fell even faster in April 2020. Second, extensive supply chain issues are affecting the economy and leading to higher prices. Think the shortage in semiconductors for cars and trucks, as well as delays in meeting demand for household appliances. And third, the M2 measure of the money supply is up 27% versus a year ago. The first two factors, the base effect and the supply chain issues, are temporary. The third issue, the huge increase in money supply, will affect inflation over the long term. The Fed seems to anticipate that after peaking later this year due to this base effect and supply chain issues, inflation will subside later this year and in 2022. We think the waning inflation later this year due to the first two factors will be temporary as the increase in money supply gains traction. In other words, the Fed thinks recent higher inflation is temporary. We think any deceleration in inflation later this year is a temporary phenomenon. In terms of details of March price for goods, it led overall indexes higher, with the bulk of that coming from the 5.9% increase in energy costs. The index for gasoline alone increased 8.8%. The food index rose 0.5% in March as increased costs of poultry were partially offset by lower prices for beef and veal. Prices for services jumped 0.7% in March. Within services, final demand trade services, think margins for the receivers by wholesalers and retailers, were the key contributor to higher costs, consistent with supply chain problems. Meanwhile, transportation and warehousing services had an outsized increase in the third consecutive quarter. Further down the pipeline, prices for intermediate demand processed goods rose 4% in March, while intermediate demand unprocessed goods rose 9.3% and are up at an astonishing 70.1% annualized rate in the last 6 months. Intermediate unprocessed goods are up 41.6% from a year ago and have shown significant movement since bottoming out at a 28.6% 12-month decline back in April of 2020. However, don't expect the Fed to signal any change in the plan to keep short-term rates near zero for the foreseeable future. The Fed wants inflation to trend above the 12% target for a prolonged period, with the labor market on the other side of the Fed's dual mandate also has to heal considerably further to get the Fed to seriously consider a move higher. Expect inflation pressures to remain a dominant topic of conversation throughout the year end. In recent news in the labor market, initial jobless claims rose 16,000 last week, while continuing claims declined 16,000. As we saw with March's uniform payroll gain, 916,000 job growth is reaccelerating with the ease of restrictions across the country as vaccinations continue to rise. Expect significant job gains in the months ahead as we get back towards normal. And February's international trade report also came out this week, and the trade deficit in goods and services grew to $71.1 billion in February, the largest on record, as both exports and imports declined, but exports declined faster than imports. These drops come on the back of some very solid months of trade, and we do not believe is a new trend. Severe winter weather wreaked havoc across much of the United States in February, basically shutting down many states for an extended period, which took a large toll on trade. In fact, after 13 months of petroleum surplus, the trend reversed in February as the dollar value of U.S. petroleum exports was smaller than U.S. petroleum imports. While we do not believe that this will continue for more than a few months, if that long, as weather has a one-off factor. Horizontal drilling and fracking have transformed the global energy market, and the U.S. is no longer hostage to foreign oil. Expect trade to keep expanding in the coming months as businesses across the U.S. get back on their feet as the COVID-19 vaccine continues to roll out. But we could continue to see larger deficits in the months ahead as the U.S. is recovering from the coronavirus pandemic faster than most other countries. This means the demand for imports should continue to outstrip the demand for exports for the rest of the world right now. And as we have said over and over, the best estimates of the economy could possibly ask for is for a COVID-19 vaccine. Now we have 219 million doses distributed in the U.S., with 169 million of them administered, mostly to those 65 years of age or over. The economy is starting to return to normal. The last thing it needs right now is too much fiscal stimulus. Dick Donahue with you with Wealth Wake Up here on KGMI. We'll be right back. Welcome to Wealth Wake Up. This is Dick Donahue with you this Sunday morning here on KGMI. The March Institute of Supply Management Non-Manufacturing Index report also came out this week, and following in the steps of last week's report on manufacturing, the ISM report on the service sector was a blowout. The 8.4-point jump In the headline index represents the second largest monthly rise in series history, behind just June of last year, when the index was emerging from the shelter-in-place orders that decimated activity, and the March reading of 63.7 is the single highest reading since recording began back in 1997. All 18 industries reported growth on the month, a feat rarely seen even in the best of months. Given its broad-based pickup in activity, it's a little surprise that survey respondent comments remained overwhelmingly positive. Where cautious comments did appear, they tended to revolve around continued supply chain issues. Note the supplier delivery index, which rises as companies report longer delivery delays, rising to 61 from 60.8 in February, which in turn putting upward pressure on prices. 30 commodities reported up in price, 16 listed in short supply in March, driving the prices paid index to the highest reading in more than a decade at 74. The two most forward-looking indices, businesses activity and new orders, surged in March, both hitting new series highs. A combination of the vaccine rollout, states easing restrictions, and some make-up activity following February's harsh winter weather and blackouts provided a tailwind. With demand rising, companies moved to fill positions, as shown by the employment index, was rising to 57.2 from 53.7 in February. As the report in employment shows, last week, job gains accelerated in March due to the same factors that boosted ISM reports, and we forecast strong growth and continue as we move forward in the second half of the year. We now have three vaccines being distributed. All three are ramping up production. With each passing day, we get one step closer to getting back to normal. That, not checks out of Washington, is the best possible stimulus the U.S. economy could ask for. In other recent news, cars and light trucks sold at a 17.75 million annual rate in March. Sales increased 12.6% from February and were a massive 56.2% up from a year ago, when restrictions began to go in place across the country. The rebound in March also included some delayed activity due to February storms, so expect sales to temper in April, but continue at a solid pace as the weather warms and the economy reopens. Well, congratulations. You're retired. Now what? Well, you know, planning for retirement might have been years in the making, or it could have just sprung up on you quite suddenly. Regardless of how you got to the top of the mountain, you are at the apex of a climb that took over 40 or more years. And you may be thinking, now what, when it comes to your personal finances? Well, compared to the rules and regulations that govern nearly every financial move of the transition to retirement, there really isn't much structure to retirement years. Yet hidden away are many tasks you'll need to complete, update, and revise every year. Let's pull together a framework that addresses important financial obligations and family opportunities important throughout these three decades of retirement. Call it your Living in Retirement calendar. Mark your transition into retirement by reaching certain age milestones. Reaching certain birthdays in our 50s, 60s, and 70s triggered key decisions to specific actions. There isn't a single person in America who doesn't know that they can claim Social Security at age 62. It comes with permanently reduced payments, but they know that that age, it opens the door. Most folks know that Medicare starts at 65. If they don't enroll in time, they know that they'll be hit with a permanent penalty. And there's a lot of concern about how to avoid the 50% IRS penalty after age 72 if required minimum distributions, or RMDs, are not taken on time. Until 2020, that age was 70 and a half. But then what? After claiming Social Security, enrollees in medicine and Medicare, and started required minimum distributions, does one float financially adrift for the next 30 years? Well, not exactly. There are important obligations around the financial and tax side of retirement. The difference is no one is there to remind you to do these tasks, and mistakes are costly. So once you're fully engaged in living and in retirement, it's up to you to schedule these dates and times into your calendar, managing them squarely on your shoulders. So let's start out here. Let's build your post-retirement action plan with annual to-dos. Tax rules are a good place to start. Building your annual living and retirement calendar, April 15th is still tax day. So you can mark that down on your calendar. In addition, you'll be in charge of the other lesser well-known retirement tasks, including calculating your RMD, because you must take your first RMD at age 72. But that is just the first of many required distributions. RMDs are annual calculations and distributions every year that you live in retirement. The amounts you must distribute will change every year based on your December 31st account balance and your age. Fortunately, most large financial companies offer a free RMD service if you sign up for it. They do the math and make sure you move the money from tax-deferred to taxable accounts. You can choose distribution payments quarterly, monthly, or annually. That will keep you in the clear from any nasty 50% IRS late RMD penalty, but you're still on the hook for managing your accounts and confirming distributions. Next, calculating your Social Security taxable amount. Many retirees learn that half or more of their Social Security benefits are taxable. How much is deemed ordinary income depends on their overall financial situation each year, and you can count on your tax liability changing every year. Therefore, it's up to you and every retiree to calculate their Social Security taxable amount and report it to the IRS on your Form 1040 every year. You'll find a worksheet in the IRS publication 915. Then you also need to add your quarterly payment dates to your calendar. It is insufficient to build a living in retirement calendar with only 1 year of financial events. In particular, two items tend to sneak up on unsuspecting retirees. One is determining your estimated quarterly taxes. You know, leaving your paycheck behind means now that you must take reins when it comes to timely income tax payments. Paying quarterly estimated taxes may well be required. It's going to be up to you or your tax accountant to determine estimated payments based on anything considered income. FYI, this now includes your Social Security. You become responsible for sending payments to the IRS and your state treasury every quarter. And quarters aren't that what you think. The IRS's quirky quarter deadlines April 15th, June 15th, September 15th, and January 15th. Then there's paying of property taxes. It's a major financial win when you make that last mortgage payment. But unknown to many, the mortgage company will no longer pay your semi-annual property taxes. It's up to you to remember to pay your property taxes every period. If you have a 30-year retirement, that payments are due, and they're due semi-annually, that's 60 property tax payments that you need to make on time. Also, you need to take a fresh look at your Medicare prescription drug plan. This is really an important one. While enrolling in Medicare Part A hospitalization and Part B doctors is generally a once-in-a-lifetime event, it's not the same for Part D. Part D helps you pay for your prescription drugs every fall from October 15th through December 7th. You'll want to review your Part D coverage. It's here that there's a change. The price of your drugs increased, premiums went up, your plan no longer covers one or more of your drugs, or you're taking new drugs. You can change your drug plan and the insurance company for one with better pricing. Since drugs you take are the same regardless of the insurance company providing your insurance, you are shopping for the best overall price combination of monthly premium and total costs. The insurance companies continually tinker with their pricing every year. There's no reason to pay more than you have to. It's up to you to review your plan each year, make a new selection as needed. Mark October 15th on your calendar. And more action items, financial decisions. When you think about your living in retirement calendar, not every financial action is tax-based. Take a look for future years, mark down when to revisit. One suggestion is use a 5-0 plan, that's 5-0, using birthdays that end in 5 or 0 as markers to revisit your big plans and make any updates or changes. Here are a few examples. Revisit your estate plan every 5 years. Make sure you still agree with the executor that you chose 5 years ago. Consider your health care instructions and directives in light of new updated laws and your health condition. This is especially important if you relocated to a different state. Review your living engagement and housing options. Might it be time to move closer to children or downsize and simplify? Can you safely manage the stairs in that outdated bathroom? While this is an emotional change, it's important to think about your options and rethink travel. As we age, it becomes harder and harder to travel and spend time away from home. It might be helpful to plan big trips early in retirement. Perhaps you plan international travel between 70 and 80, then switch to new U.S. travel between 80 and 90. So maybe you want to build yourself a living calendar. Here's an idea. January, you have your prior year fourth quarter estimate. IRS taxes due on January 15. Calculate your current year RMDs to take out of your retirement plans. So in February, you take your first RMD payment, say one of four if you're taking them quarterly. April, you got to pay those property taxes. Also in April, you have April 15th tax filing. May, you need to take your RMD payment again. June, pay your second estimated quarterly payments by June 15th at your IRS. July, if this is a birthday year ending at 5 or 0, take a new look at some of your big plans. Discuss your prior realities and priorities and arrangements and travel plans. August, take that next RMD payment. Or if you're taking them monthly, take them every month, take them every quarter, take them once a year. September, pay your third quarter estimated tax on September 15th. October, don't forget to pay that second installment of your property taxes. Also in October, review your Medicare Part D, which we just mentioned. And November, take that next RMD payment. December is your final chance to make sure that you took your RMDs for the year. So what's next? After you successfully made your way into retirement, is it your own retirement financial obligations every year for 30 years? Time to find a pencil. Dick Donahue with you with Wealth Wake Up here on KGMI. We'll be right back.
'Cause there ain't no doubt I love this land. God bless the USA.
Welcome back to Wealth Wake Up. Dick Donahue with you this Sunday morning here in KGMI. You got questions for us? Give Camille or I a call, 360-733-1200. That's 360-733-1200. You know, tax incentives are no way to drive energy innovation. Let's talk a little bit about why. So the best ways to tame environmentally harmful emissions is to allow private sector to innovate cleaner and more efficient ways to produce, distribute, and use energy. Unfortunately, government subsidies, mandates, and other regulations largely fail to spur such developments and instead bolster government-favored technologies. The latest example of this is a recent proposal from the House Ways and Means Committee to extend a long list of energy tax credits. One of the credits extended in the package, the Carbon Capture Tax Credit, provides a cautionary tale for policymakers who hope to direct energy innovations with subsidies from Washington. The Carbon Capture Tax Credit, which some call 45Q after its tax code section, lowers the tax bill of energy companies based on how much carbon dioxide is captured and sequestered underground in special geological formations. Companies received $50 for every captured or sequestered metric ton of carbon dioxide, or $35 a ton if the captured carbon dioxide is used to enhance oil recovery. The process of capturing carbon, and this tax credit seeks to incentivize, is considered by some an effective way to mitigate the release of emissions from fossil fuels. But past examples of carbon capture and storage programs show this technology is not viable, even with big subsidies. The Petra Nova coal plant in Texas is an example. They were once held up by proponents of the carbon capture and storage process as a success story. It just closed down. Fueled by direct subsidies, generous tax credits, the plant's owner, NRG Energy, was able to implement the carbon capture and storage systems, making Petra Nova the only carbon capture coal plant in America. But it did come at a cost. The processes to remove carbon from the plant's emissions required so much energy that NRG made an entirely separate natural gas power plant just to power the scrubber. The natural gas emissions were not captured or offset. Petra Nova dramatically illustrates the failure of politically motivated energy projects. Previous government directed attempts to get carbon capture and storage technology off the ground also squandered hundreds of millions in taxpayer money. Time and time again, Congress creates new temporary subsidies to prop up politically popular nascent technologies that claim to need government help just to get on our feet. But these temporary subsidies seldom die. Instead, the companies become dependent on them and limp along in a wasteful and inefficient manner. In fact, some proponents of carbon capture have called 45Q a make-or-break element of the technology's future success. This is a recipe for dependence. Tax credits has also been issued for wind power, solar energy, electric cars, and biofuels, to name a few. Each of these credits were designed to get fledgling industries off the ground. As they begin to expire, the industries pursued fierce lobbying to expand the subsidies to make them permanent. Companies that do not receive any preferential treatment are also incentivized to lobby for tax subsidies simply to level the playing field. The result is a hodgepodge of tax credits benefiting select technologies that members of Congress support, even if the support harms the country as a whole, despite benefiting their districts or states. It is by no means an effective way to reduce carbon dioxide emissions, as many of the subsidies carry significantly higher abatement costs. Besides lost revenue, tax subsidies have many other significant hidden costs to American taxpayers. Because private capital or investment is limited, technologies that do not receive subsidies appear to be more expensive, risky, or unpromising. Thus, the government discourages private investments in projects that lack the government's blessing, but may actually be more commercially promising. In other words, a dollar invested in a company that benefits from a tax credit cannot be invested simultaneously in another company. This creates opportunity costs that are potentially promising, but unsubsidized technologies may not receive equal treatment. Business models built around taxpayer-funded life subsidies also distort the incentive that drives innovation. Preferential tax treatment reduces the necessity for an industry to make its technology cost competitive because the tax credit shields a company from recognizing the actual price at which the technology is economically viable. The government should not prop up energy source. They should instead allow competitive markets to meet Americans' energy needs. However well-intentioned tax subsidies look for that, like more corporate welfare for politically connected industries, and much less effective at spurring a dominant world-class energy sector. Well, got another report here again. The Congressional Budget Office now has joined a long list of professionals that says that a capital gains tax is an income tax. And this is from a March 22nd, 2021 Congressional Budget Office report. This is capital income taxes are taxes on the return on an investment. We've been talking about this for quite a while, but Congressional Budget Office is another one that comes out and says that this proposed state capital gains tax is, in fact, an income tax, which is against the state constitution. Okay, let's hit on something else here. This last week, on the basis of whole cloth lies, major corporations went to political war with the state of Georgia. The lies at issue revolved around Georgia's new voting law, characterized by both Stacey Adams and President Biden as a new form of Jim Crow. What do these drastically new voter restrictions do? They require an ID number to receive an absentee ballot with language identical to that of the federal law. They bar electioneering within 150 feet of a polling place or 25 feet of voters in line, including handing out food or water for partisan purposes. They increase the number of mandatory days of weekend early voting. They preserve some drop boxes that did not exist before the pandemic, and they require additional voting machines and election personnel in crowded precincts. They increase voting hours in future elections for the vast majority of the counties. These provisions are similar to the laws in a vast majority of other states. They didn't stop Democrats and the media from simply lying about the Georgia voting law. While some in the media did point out that Biden had lied about the law's supposed crackdown on voting hours, nobody in the media treated this Jim Crow contentions with the sneering disrespect that so richly deserved. Instead, they simply parroted the line that Republicans were engaged in widespread voter suppression, another lie. A lie far more unsubstantiated than Republicans' concerns about voter fraud and integrity. But the media and the Democrats even went further. They bullied corporations that had taken positions on Georgia election law. CBS News put out a headline that trafficked in simple activism. Three ways companies can help fight Georgia's restrictive new voting law, and companies complied. Coca-Cola, in line with its new Woca-Cola brand, issued a statement deploring an election law that corporation hadn't bothered to lobby against its passage in the first place. Delta issued a statement too, with CEO of Ed Bastien explaining, "I need to make it clear that the final bill is unacceptable and does not match Delta's values." Major League Baseball followed Biden's advice and pulled the All-Star game out of the state. So what do conservatives do? Well, many conservatives, including myself, deplore the politics of boycotts. We're not interested in patronizing companies based on political differentiation alone. But if the left is going to hijack the most powerful institutions in America and then weaponize them against voters in red states, conservatives will be left with little choice but to exert counter pressure. The only alternative is the formation of alternative companies in every industry. If Coca-Cola wishes to cater to the woke, conservatives will need to build a competitor. Conservatives don't have first mover advantage in these spaces, but that doesn't alleviate their responsibility to find a different path than funding those who would cut them off at the knees. The left has politicized everything. The right has avoided that tactic because it's ugly and divisive, but it's too late to put the genie back in the bottle. It's time to mutually assured destruction. There's only one thing worse than having nuclear weapons: unilateral disarmament. Better to establish mutually assured destruction now and put corporate America on notice that by stepping into the middle of a fraught political debate, it risks just as much blowback from the right as from the left. Dick Donahue with you with Wealth Wake Up here on KGMI. Thanks for being with us. Don't forget our live shows on Saturdays at 11. If you got questions for us, give us a call, 360-733-1200. Thanks and have a great week.